Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 373, I chat with mastering engineer Eric Boulanger about his work at his audio mastering facility, The Bakery. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded September 28th, 2017, episode 373, Audio Mastering at the Bakery. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Eric Boulanger, the mastering engineer and founder of The Bakery, an audio mastering facility on the lot of Sony Pictures. Hey, Eric, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be a geek.
You are my guest geek and a proud geek, I hope, as well as I am.
Yep.
Those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv. And you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps if you put my screen name somewhere in the message, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes. That way it shows up in a different color on my screen, and I can more easily find it. So, Eric, how did you become a mastering engineer?
Well, I guess the long story short was I've been a violinist my whole life. My parents, for whatever reason, put the violin in my hands when I was three and never really got a good explanation out of them. I think they probably saw an ad in a newspaper and decided, yeah, that sounds about right. And so I've been ever since, I still play professionally. I play for film and TV soundtracks and whatnot. And so I've been a musician my entire life, was always studying. And then come college age, I kind of had a change of heart from not wanting to do conservatory anymore, and I figured that I would go to a university. I'd apply for a university so that I could do music and something else. And at an early age, kind of like high school age and everything, I was getting bitten by the tech bug and the recording bug, but it wasn't until university where they had a recording studio. And by today's standards, it's quite a small, quaint recording studio. But
yeah, I remember the one in my college as well. Yeah,
exactly. But when I walked in there, I was just like, yep, this is me. This is what I want to do. So being as though there was no music production program or something that would be highly specialized towards, you know, what we do here in the studio, I decided, well, I already know the music side. I might as well study electrical engineering. And so I went in, got in as a violinist, left as an ECE major. And very random, but I was a straight C student and don't care because unlike my roommates who are working for like Lockheed Martin and whatnot, I was going to Capitol Records.
right. Where they so probably didn't care too much about your grades, but more, can you deliver the goods?
Yeah, and literally at that age as an intern, delivering the goods is, you know, the pizza that came in or the coffee, more specifically. So, an advanced degree really doesn't serve much purpose in that regard. But, Capitol Studios was my first professional experience where I was actually their first ever intern. It's kind of unbelievable that that's the case. But, of course, the record label upstairs always had interns, but the studios never did. And who knows why, doesn't matter. But somehow I talked it into my first boss, Paula Salvatore, and she let me intern there. And through that, that's how I got to mentor with Al Schmidt and pretty much, you know, learn everything and started.
You'd learn some serious stuff from Al Schmidt, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, you know, it was funny. I only recently even would tell him what my personal game was, but you know, we were always in charge of the setup of the studio for the sessions that were rolling in. And Al records there so much that his setup is well known by anyone who works there. And so the little game I would always play with myself is to set everything up, and as the musicians come in, try to quickly make small adjustments, and then watch as Al would come in and see which mics he would readjust. And there was one session where he didn't readjust anything, and I was like, aha, got him.
You got him. So, or what you had done, you know, he decided, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the games you get to play as an intern, you know. You're there to learn, and you're there to shut up. So
yeah, right.
I wasn't about to quiz him on my performance, but I could definitely stand back and see what he changes. So that was always really fun. Mm-hmm. And so when I permanently moved out to LA, of course, you know, I needed to put food on the table. And it so happened that Doug Sex was looking for a new engineer. And so Al was the conduit of that. And so to answer your question on how I got into mastering, because I always thought I was getting into recording or mixing or something like that, the way I got into mastering was Al Schmidt told me to go interview with Doug Sex. And when that happens, you get in the car and don't ask questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Doug Sax, of course, is one of the preeminent mastering engineers ever. He has since passed away, I believe, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You sat at the feet of the master for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Well, not only preeminent, but I would, you know, point out pioneering too, because he legitimately invented what we now know as mastering. He was the first independent mastering engineer in studio. And what we mean by independent is back in, you know, the 60s, early 60s, 50s, it was always, it was even termed transfer engineers, not even mastering engineers, because most records were done by the labels, where they had their own studios, they had their own engineers, they had their own staff producers. They did everything vertically integrated. And the transfer engineer was just there to get it onto vinyl. And, you know, Doug was working with Lincoln Mayorga at the time, and they did their own recordings. And it was the first time that they did direct-to-disc recordings. And both of them heard what they had recorded, and they're like, this sounds nothing like what we pick up in stores. What's going wrong? And they realized that there really is a lot more in getting things onto a disc than what the industry had been doing. And they decided there was a business there and opened up shop. And sure enough, you know, producers and artists started finding out about that and hearing the sound, and then forcing their labels to go there. And then it took off. And so that's, you know, mm-hmm. that's his contribution in literally inventing what we know now as mastering.
So what are some of the things that he discovered or developed that needed to be done in order to improve how the recording got into the final distribution format?
Well, that's the beauty of it. And a lot of what we do with mastering too, which is, there was nothing invented. It's not like you were inventing the flux capacitor or something. You know? Only process. He was bringing about the process of mastering for the first time. And so it's all the same equipment, but in making this a step, and how we master, the philosophy of it, how to listen, and the detail that's involved with all of it, you know, that detail goes into, of course, all the equipment and you know, what you're doing to make sure that there's as much resolution as possible. So really, in this new form of mastering and independent nature from, like, you know, the old factory system of labels, It's just really pouring so much more detail and attention into every step along the way of what has to happen to get that record on a store shelf.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine the process includes things like EQ, perhaps re-EQing some things, or
sure,
dynamically compressing things. What are elements of that process?
Well, the basics of it, Doug was always king of if it needs nothing, do nothing, which is
good philosophy. I agree.
Oh, absolutely. Which still applies to today. And, you know, it's really fun getting the opportunity for me to speak to classes or students. And it's funny because, like, I'll always preach the same thing, you know, if it needs nothing, do nothing, which is very difficult for even professional engineers because it's like they feel like they have to do something since you're charging them money. And then I find it funny when I say this to students because it's like, well, the one thing we at least get to benefit from is we have the best of mixers and producers and artists walking in this door. So the likelihood that it needs nothing is rather high. And, you know, thinking back to my college days, if I were doing the same tasks, the likelihood of it needing nothing is 0%. So, you know, it's definitely a different circumstance. So we have to take that with a grain of salt. But, you know, his philosophy was always that. So at least in those days when everything was analog, so the mixes are coming in on a mix down, like an analog tape going straight to the lathe. You know, the best case scenario is where it needs no EQ or compression or anything like that. Just let's set the cutting level. The tape's all sequenced and edited together. You might have fades, which, mind you, in those days, all of this you had to do manually and on the fly. And
so like fade outs, for example, at the end of a song that didn't have a definite ending.
Yeah, well, many times a lot of fades, it's just elected that masterings to do it. And that's usually because at the mix stage or after they've mixed down a song, you know, there's a lot of songs where the band's just riffing and going along or whatever, and they just haven't decided if they want to have the ending or not yet. So they leave it for the last second, where obviously we can do it too. There's also other considerations with how you hit tape or if you're using noise reduction or something like that. Of course, if you were to do the fade out on the console in the mix stage, you're going to end up with more noise in that fade out than if we do it live on the console here, where then the only noise that's going into the system is the actual lathe itself. But so that could be an engineering decision between the mixer and the mastering engineer. But oftentimes it just randomly turns out that we would be doing the fades. So that would have to be done on the fly as you're cutting the disc. So that's one facet that always made cutting in those days very difficult, was because it really was almost like a performance every time you had to cut something.
Right.
So, you know, the if it needs nothing, do nothing aspect is you pay a lot of attention to your tape machine, your tape heads, your selection, your preamp for the tape machine, how good everything sounds, and then use the shortest piece of wire to get it into the lathe. And then, of course, your electronics and sonics of the lathe and whatnot, and carry on. If it needs EQ, then you pop it in and you EQ it. If it needs compression, then you can do it. But those are all just artistic questions. But the base of everything is, how do I go from one format to another as resolute as possible?
Right, right. One of the issues that I think really pertains most to mastering engineers than others, mixers or recording engineers, is what we often call the loudness wars.
Sure.
Can you explain what that is and what your philosophy about it is?
Well, war is probably the worst way of explaining this.
All right, but that's the common term, isn't it? I mean, you know.
It's definitely the term, and we all know what we're talking about with that. You know, the propensity for everything over the years to get louder and louder and louder, and, of course, technology completely plays into that. You know, you didn't have excellent digital limiters like we do today back in the 50s, and hence nothing was really loud. So, you know, the loudness wars, the reason why war is kind of a bad ideal is because it's more like a plague.
Oh, let's call them the loudness plague then.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's focused on the loudness wars or plague, whatever you want to call it, is focused on the production end. You know, everybody loves to moan and groan about, oh, this mastering engineer is always so damn loud, and this producer like cuts loud records and blah, 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 blah. And it always is focused on the production end. And yet the reason why it's a plague is it's not like this is some conspiracy where we all get together and we're like, hey, let's mess
the
up
secret the lair
and take away all dynamics from anything that we release, you know, like that's not it. You know, also I don't make my business on like, I guarantee you my phone does not ring and say, hey, Eric, you make the loudest records. I want to book you. That also never happens. So, you know, the reason why it's a plague is because, well, A, of course, we're doing it and we feel pressure. Fine. That's what everyone understands. The second half is words cannot describe how many times. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. Like, I should start just taking a tally. What does get booked with me is I'll get the phone call. Hey, love your work on this, blah, blah, blah. I've got this really dynamic record. I don't want it loud. I want it, like, really audiophile and blah, blah, blah. Great. We do it. We make a fantastic-sounding record. What's the note? It always comes back 24 hours later from the artist. Man, I love the sound of this record. It's great. Can you just make it louder? And it's like, that's when you want to shoot yourself in the face. It's like, okay, what am I not getting here? So the plague then extends, of course, to the artist where, you know, they're comparing themselves against everything else that's out there. Okay, great. We get that. But now it's been such a plague that, well, let's talk about loudness normalization for a little bit, which I've done extensive work with. And it's great. We're getting there, but there's many problems.
Define loudness normalization first.
So loudness normalization would be like sound check with iTunes or replay gain, which I believe, Spotify uses. Things like BS 1770 or, you know, the ITU standards that broadcast uses, their loudness models, everything that converts measurements into loudness units, full scale, LUFS, so that you have a sensibility of the perceived loudness of a track or a performance, whatever you're doing. And the loudness normalization, the first problem with it is amongst all of these platforms, let's say iTunes, Spotify, Tidal, you know, all of those platforms, there's no standard. They're all different. The most simplest place where we should start is just say, hey, the target's going to be minus 16, done. And there's no standard even between like movies and music. So there's a bit of a problem there because obviously, as a mastering engineer, if there was a magic genie who could come out of a lamp and the entire planet, every single thing that plays any music suddenly will be target minus 16 LUFS, then as a mastering engineer, of course, what I'm going to do is I'm going to set up my monitoring chain to reflect 16 dB of headroom and where I can make masters that hit that target exactly so that when you upload that master and it gets played by a consumer, there's no extra DSP, there's no extra you know, trickery being done to attenuate that signal down to the target level. It's just perfect. It's how it's meant to be. That's the idea.
And the different, if you play different programs, different songs, listen to different radio stations or streaming services or whatever, they would all be at that same level.
Exactly. Which
that would be the goal.
That would be the goal, and that's the idea. And you know, the problems with how that's working right now is not only the fact that there's no standard, but also the loudness profiles, the algorithms that determine loudness. Of course, you know, the first example that everyone loves to use is like classical music. You know, if you have a Rolling Stones album, you know, the level's pretty damn consistent from song to song to song. Mm. But what about Brahms' Second, where it blows up at the ends, but 99% of it, like 60 minutes of music, is, you know, at triple piano.
Right.
You know, that's a very difficult question for any of these algorithms to really judge. So there's been plenty of work put into exactly that, but that problem's always going to kind of exist. But that's neither here nor there. The point I was going to bring up with a lot of the work that I've done, specifically with Soundcheck and when I was working with Mastered for iTunes, was, to my surprise, what I would do is, and Al Schmidt's a perfect example. I was using some of the work that we had done at the mastering lab at the time. You know, you take a lush Al mix, where you would think that loudness normalization would completely benefit that type of sound and music, where it's a little laid back, and now it doesn't have to compete against anything, and it can be in all its glory. So I would take the original master, see how much attenuation needed to be done by analyzing it, and then I'd rerun the master so that it would hit that exact mark, not need any limiting or anything, and then I compared it to. Now, they're matched level, and I'm just comparing which sounds better. And to my absolute shock, the one that was made louder and pulled down, I kept on picking. Now, this wasn't always the case with other mixes and everything, but like the one that I thought would benefit the most wasn't even benefiting at all. And then I realized, of course, you know, it's not there for making it loud, but the gentle amount of squeeze that Doug had put on really was working artistically with the master, and that's part of what everybody liked. So, you know, that doesn't mean that this process is impossible. What it means is the idea of compression or a little bit of limiting or something like that has to be rethought for if we ever got that genie to work his magic. you know, the idea of compression will have to be reworked a little bit, especially for tools where you can still artistically use that, but it's for the tonality as opposed to we need to make this louder. So that's one aspect of what I've worked on that was really surprising and needs work. And then the last part that I think no one thinks about with loudness is the manufacturing, the hardware ends of consumer everything. I mean, not that I like this whatsoever, but if that genie were to work his magic, think about how many like of those Bluetooth speakers are out there where everyone's having their pool party. Mm. Now the signal's 16 dB down. Do you think those things stand a chance in hell of even being heard if this is implemented? Of course not. And it's because there's so many, of course, it's usually the cheaper, the lower end audio. So, you know, think what you want about this comment, but still it's ubiquitous. There's so much hardware out there that's going to suffer from the fact that we'd have this lower signal now. And the funny part is that's why this is the loudness plague. The plague reached all the way up into the hardware designer's table, where they're expecting loud compressed music. And they're like, well, we don't need to use very powerful amplifiers or anything. And now we can put it into the battery and have these small speakers that actually make a lot of noise. And so it's like the hardware design of so much hardware that's out there for a consumer is even affected by the loudness plague. I think I'll just point this now. Thank you, Scott.
Very good. Very good. You can trademark that. That's fine. just one comment from the chat room here at this point. User 4949 says, worse in this loudness thing is The Weeknd. You know this artist, The Weeknd?
Sure.
And his tune, The Hills. That song, when it gets to the hook, you can almost hear an auto gain control on it.
Well, so, I'm going to have to take his word for it.
Since yeah, I haven't heard it either.
But, you know, that sort of thing, too, is many, many people in production, whether it be a mastering engineer, a mixer, or a producer, will put dynamics into songs. So, you know, when you hear something as abrupt like that, it was probably on purpose and meant to...
Meant as an effect.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah, but sort of like auto-tune. In some cases, exactly. When a singer will use heavy, heavy auto-tune, you know, that's what it's meant to sound that way. It's kind of artificial.
Well, a lot of mixers, too, you know, will use a lot of compression from a tonality standpoint in what they do. And in doing so, like if you want to think of your traditional like rock or pop song, where you have a verse and a chorus, if you lay on that thick compression, then the whole song is kind of at one dynamic level. So after the fact,
right,
they'll go in and do gain rides on the verses to take them down and make it more musical, where, you know, the verse with just a singer and a piano and a guitar sound at one level. And then when the whole, you know, gospel choir comes in, it's like, it sounds louder because there's more elements. So,
yeah.
That could be what's going on there. I can't.
Yeah, we don't know for sure.
No, for sure.
a couple other questions here. Rev Dan Oreo asks if you know Bob Heil. He's a member of the Twit family here. He did a lot of live sound systems that Doug Sachs mastered some albums for some of those groups.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I know of him. I don't know him personally, but certainly know of his work. So.
Yeah. He's been on this show a couple times. And he has his own podcast on the same Twit network about ham radio. He's a big, serious ham radio guy.
Oh, wow. That's no surprise either.
Really? Beatmaster in the chat room is asking, did the advent of DAWs, digital audio workstations, and virtual instruments change the type of mastering duties that you do?
Absolutely. It's really fun when people visit the studio, or, you know, you meet someone at a bar and, oh, what do you do? I'm a mastering engineer. And then you have to explain what the heck that is. And of course, you know, the textbook will tell you there's recording, mixing, and mastering, and that these duties are clearly defined. And if there's anything the DAWs have done is to blur those lines immensely, where, you know, the duties of what used to be traditionally a step now could be done anywhere. And so really my duties as a mastering engineer really does change from project to project immensely. And it totally is just because technology and DAWs have enabled that. You know, that would be very difficult to do on a tape machine with a 24 track and a mix down and everything, you'd be spending forever. But with DAWs, it makes life goes a lot quicker then. So, you know, you find yourself as a mastering engineer giving notes to a producer about what guitar lick they're re-recording.
Okay, so the lines get blurred.
They're very blurred, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Charlie X is asking, do you ever do half-speed mastering?
I do.
Tell us what that is and what it's good for.
Well, I don't know if I'm at a... Darn. This really hurts very much because I don't think I'm at liberty to discuss two projects that are that are extremely exciting. One's
okay.
Hence a classical remastering, so I think you guys can all get what I'm talking about. One's a brand new album, and I absolutely can't say anything. And it's definitely not classical, but both I did half speed because of their dynamic range. And because it's very simple, like, you know.
So I guess you play the track back at half speed and master right?
Well, I'm sorry. We should elaborate, too. I just dove right into this question. When he says half speed mastering, he's talking about cutting lacquers only for vinyl. So, of course, I wouldn't be mastering things over here and listening to music at half speed. I'd probably hang myself. But no, this is strictly for cutting lacquers and making the master lacquer that goes to electroplating and the pressing plant.
Vinyl records is what we're talking about here.
Exactly. So the benefit of this is, of course, mainly because of the RAA curve, the pre-emphasis curve in a cutting amp. It's a pretty much 6 dB per octave curve the whole way. You're up 20 at 20K, you're down 20 at 20 hertz about. So across the whole audio spectrum, you know, it's pretty much 40 dB of pre-emphasis, which is massive. And so when you do half speed mastering, you play your content at half the speed, and instead of going 33 and a third that you're playing, you're going 16 and two thirds RPM, so half the speed. And it takes you twice as long now to cut this. What ends up happening, yeah, is the whole frequency range, the whole spectrum of what you're cutting, now every frequency is divided in half. So 2K becomes 1K, 1K becomes 500. Now, one of the downsides of half speed is 40 hertz becomes 20 and 20 becomes 10. And now you're working into, you know, the frequency response of your cutter head. We're down there, it starts falling off very rapidly. So for something extremely bass heavy, this might not be a good idea. But the main thing is you get so much better high-end response because all cutter heads kind of go crazy above 10K. It's where their active feedback starts falling out, and that has a lot of issues. It's where a lot of mechanical dampening and whatnot starts playing into effect. There's a whole slew of problems. So, you know, the fact that 20K now becomes 10K, you're out of that range. So you'll get a much more linear high end, which is something especially audiophiles really enjoy. But the main thing and the main reason why these two albums that, oh, I wish I could tell you guys.
we'll have you back when you can talk about it.
Oh yeah, definitely, because these two are very exciting. The main reason for it is since you have this huge pre-emphasis curve, when you do everything half speed, you also half your power requirement of the cutting amp. So what does that mean? You can cut twice as loud, which is...
Oh really no, fun. Back to the loudness plague.
Yeah, the loudness plague, but this is vinyl, so louder is better because there really is no stopping it. Like with half speed, the fact of the matter is I can cut unplayable records. Like it's just down to the point where, you know, the lathe can outperform any pickup or turntable at those levels. But so that's of course a consideration. But with dynamic records and things that need to be cut loud, half speed is almost the only way, because you don't blow up your cutter head or your amp.
Both worthy goals, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. And I've done both, so it's really not right. Fun.
No, I'm sure not.
Gets very expensive. Well, listen, too.
I wanted to ask you about your current facility called The Bakery, mm-hmm. Which is on the lot of Sony Pictures. So I wanted to ask you how this came to be. How did you end up on the Sony lot?
Well, it's a total honor to be here. And I mean, the Thalberg building that we're located in is even a historic landmark. I mean, if these walls could talk, it'd be very interesting and scary probably at the same time. But, of course, this used to be the MGM lot. And how this all came to be was my violin, that since I still play professionally on soundtracks and whatnot, I used to record here all the time. Not, you know, even having an inkling of moving in here. And when I started thinking about, you know, opening up shop and wanting to lease space, the one thing I knew was I could never do the buy a house, build a studio in a garage thing. It's just not me. Like, I would hang myself just from not having social contact. So I knew I had to be somewhere creative. And I had even spoken with, Jeff Greenberg over at The Village. And because The Village is exactly that concept, I mean, even in the name. And it's an incredible facility. And, you know, it's a bunch of musicians and producers all in one spot. It's exactly what I would want. There's only one problem. It's like people have to drop dead before their room is built. You know, and Jeff, I think, has turned every closet in that place into a studio. So
I've been there. I know that's true.
Yeah. There's literally just no space. So that wouldn't have worked out, even though it would be a dream. And never mind, I love all the guys over there. So I started thinking of everything, and movie lots was one of my first thoughts. I was even thinking about museums like the Getty. You know, I know it sounds crazy, but like the fact of the matter is there's a lot of administrative lease spaces at museums, mainly for artists and whatnot, and preservationists. And so, you know, I figured maybe I'd be able to convince someone into, why not this? At least it would be creative. You know, that's just where my head was. But nonetheless, the contact here was, of course, being a regular musician here, I knew all the staff engineers, Adam Michalak and Greg Denon, and it was through them that I got connected with the executives over here at Sony, and that's how this all turned out. So it was, again, boiled down to my violin.
We have a picture, actually, of the studio that I wanted to show people. Cool. I think you're there now, but here's a picture more of the actual
exactly
room.
Literally where I'm sitting.
Oh, okay. Just looking the other way, I guess. Okay.
Yeah.
This your assistant is there too.
Oh,
also,
yes.
Also a really good mastering engineer, Jet Galinda. I've forgotten her last name.
She is literally named after Joan Jett. Her full name is Joanne Jett Galindo.
No kidding. Wow.
I'm
that's
not
so cool.
Yep, her parents are pretty damn cool.
Okay, so well, what are those speakers in the background? I have to ask you that.
They're ATCs. So the left and right, the bigger ones are ATC 150s, and the center one is ATC 50. And I chose the 50 for the center speaker just because the physical size of the same speaker in that area was actually kind of messing with my left and right imaging. I mean, and mind you, this is in Eric units. You know, Ben Lilly's a very close friend and you know, the main guy over there at ATC. And, you know, he was helping me with getting everything started here in that sense. And he was very surprised to hear my thoughts on the fact that the 150 was interfering there. And I was just like, Ben, don't don't listen to this too much. This is just, you know, hearing flea farts here. So, and also I think that, you know, my choice in location of the speakers too might be ever so much smaller than spec. And
they look a little closer together. And what about the fact that they're, you know, obscuring the screen? You don't, you use that screen or not?
I don't even have a projector in here. I'm telling myself I'm going to use the screen one day, but haven't done it yet. Obviously, visuals aren't very important in a mastering studio.
Yeah, right. I gotcha. Well, speaking of which, what about mastering for movies? We've been talking about music recordings, and we're going to get back to that. But I just wanted to ask you, you've done some mastering. Was it for movies or was it for the soundtrack album?
Well, I've done a lot of soundtrack. And, you know, when music from movies gets mastered, it's typically only for the soundtrack. You know, what gets released as just the music product. And that's mainly because what they do on the dub stage is almost a form of mastering in a way. Not that I'm usually very happy with the turnout. that might be for a different show.
All right.
You know, I think you're probably hinting at La La Land, which was definitely a different story of the musicals.
Obviously there's a lot of mastering to do there because it is a musical.
Well, yeah, exactly. When the music is kind of like the whole point of the movie, that's when they consider things a little bit differently.
Right.
So,
right.
That's kind of a bad example, I suppose, but, yeah, that was quite fun working on that and, almost winning Best Picture.
Yeah. I watched that. That was pretty amazing.
Yeah,
that was pretty amazing. What about mastering in immersive audio, like at Dolby Atmos or DTSX?
Well, of course, this is a new thing and it's very exciting. We actually are doing that. And coincidentally, because of this arrangement of, you know, when I started this room, Sony Pictures also, there's kind of... almost an identical room right across the hallway from me. So that wasn't being used either. I'm in a hallway of screening rooms. There's still four more screening rooms surrounding us right now.
This room here where you're in used to be a screening room as well, right?
Exactly. That's why there's a screen that's not used. But
all right.
Yeah, but these two are the smallest ones actually on the lot, so they were never used. Also, my room... specifically, the screen is some weird size because it was meant for TV when they were doing like TV features to film. As you can imagine with digital, that went straight out the window very quickly. So that's why this room was just never used. It was also only film projection. But same thing with the room across the way. So they turned that around as well, and they made it into an Atmos mixing room, mainly for home authoring. So they'll do the big Atmos mix on the dub stage, and then they'll take that Atmos over to this room and do all of the Blu-ray work and little tweaks and revisions to the mix over there. So we're actually working together on a few releases that are all done in Atmos because we can link the two rooms together. It's very convenient being across the hall from all the proper equipment. And the idea here is something that's slowly catching on, and I'm pretty excited about it. I think it might just work, but you know, the idea is for a lot of big artists with on their release dates or the weekend of a release that, you know, in big cities or throughout the country, there would be actual screenings of whatever you would call it. Of playing the record in a theater that fans could go to. And, you know, it's just a totally new way to experience an album now. And I'm excited about that. We'll see what happens. It's kind of the forefront of this idea.
Mm-hmm. A couple more questions from the chat room. Subaru is asking, do you have any favorite near field speakers?
Yeah, the ATC-45s. They sound exactly like my room here. A good friend of mine and someone who I work with a lot is, you know, the incredible Joe Zook. And he just recently, and by recently, I mean like 2 years ago now, but recently finished his new studio. He actually has bought a house catty cornered from his house and turned it into an entire studio. So
wow.
I keep fun of him that he can zip line to his work. Right. Nonetheless, he finished this gorgeous mix facility for himself. And that's when he switched over to the 45s. And, you know, when he got them up and right, he asked me to come over and take a listen to everything. And we put up stuff that both of us worked on. And I was like, well, it sounds exactly like my room. So, yeah, it's perfect.
Charlie X is asking, do you receive material mostly in analog tape or digital audio file form?
Almost only. At this point, I'd say 99.9999% of anything comes in only digital now. Mm-hmm. I actually am having a hard time thinking of the last analog tape that came in here. I mean, it's been steadily decreasing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, about 6 years ago, there was a lot of tape work coming in, and it was bloody horrific because it was a bunch of, like, you know, the gearheads or the hipsters who just were enamored over tape, and they were using, like, messed up machines that they bought on eBay that obviously don't work. They were using tape that was erased 40 times. Ugh. And like there was nothing right about it. And, you know, we'd always end up sending them packing and go home and be like, okay, just bring us the files because this is garbage. And they wouldn't like to hear that, but, you know, I'm really glad that that hasn't happened anymore. But yeah, there's little tape being done.
Yeah, I would think so.
Actually, now I remember my last record. It was a Joe Purdy record, and that one was really fun. But those guys really know what they're doing with tape. So this is a very
different. Certainly there are those who really like the sound of analog tape, and use it, just like there are a few movie directors now who still prefer shooting on film. Not many, but there are some. So it stays alive.
They're all tools.
Exactly. Exactly.
If you don't know how to swing the hammer, it's useless.
I'd love to talk a little bit about some of the music projects that you've worked on. Not the current ones, because you can't talk about those or you'd have to kill us.
That'd be pretty difficult. I heard there's a lot of people on right now.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It'd be difficult. So, well, let's go to some of the ones that you have, in fact, worked on in the past. For example, Green Day is one that we have some album art of. Revolution Radio, nice album art. I was very interested in this Rufus Wainwright album.
This was a fun.
That's pretty amazing. I actually went and listened to a little bit of it. It's Shakespeare sonnets being read or sung and basically put to music. That was kind of cool.
Precisely. I think mostly they did both throughout it. There was the interludes, which were all spoken word by, you know, really famous actors or actresses. And then, you know, the true challenge of it and what was so fun was I remember when they came in, the producer, Marius DeVries, he had like the hard drive in his hand, and he came over to my desk and he just dropped it on the desk and he looks at me and he's like, good effing luck. And the reason for that is, I mean, it's this album's borderline mental because it goes from straight up, you know, opera, just like his prior album where he recorded. I'm blanking where they recorded, but it was Deutsche Grammophon recording, you know, just stereo mic. I think it was like the BBC Radio Orchestra or something. Don't quote me. I forget.
You're sort of trying to remember, and it might be that or it might not. That's fine.
Yeah. And
something along those lines.
Yeah, exactly. Big symphony orchestra, well-known, typically a performance orchestra on a stage, two mics, opera singer. It goes from that sound, the typical DG sound, all the way to like, there's like a thrashing rock song, to Florence and the Machine pop sound, to typical Rufus ballad on the piano. So like, and they're all back to back too. So it was just like
one right after the next one is completely different from the one before.
Yeah. It's like, you almost wish we're happy to hear the spoken word aspects, because it gave your ear a break in between like craziness. But, you know, so to go from one thing to another was a true challenge, just, you know, figuring out where everything should be situated properly. But man, it is an incredible album. It's really good.
Two others I want to just highlight a little bit here. One is a shameless plug for a friend of mine, Jim Self, who is a fabulous tuba player. I mean, he's an amazing tuba player. He's worked in LA for many, many decades. He was the voice of the mothership in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You remember that? That's him. And you mastered his latest album called Yo. And it's a great album art, and it's a great album. It's all Latin jazz. And
yeah,
what a wonderful
fact,
player.
Speaking
huh?
about the album art, I wish I knew his name, but I know Jim told me that the artist is the same from The Simpsons. So you might kind of notice the similarities even in this cover. So
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I just wanted to point that out. You did the mastering on that. I'm sure it was a fairly easy job as things go.
Yeah, it was less complicated, well recorded and everything, and very fun. And you know, I liked how different it was, and especially, you know, for me being a musician on soundtracks and everything. I mean, I know I'm a violinist, so like strings and brass usually don't talk to each other, but I certainly knew who Jim was.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm sure you've run across his name a lot. Yeah. I would like to hear a tale or two from is the Diana Krall album.
Oh yeah.
Which you mentioned maybe might have had a few more challenges.
Oh, this was challenging on the vinyl side, and I'm incredibly proud of this album, and it was definitely bittersweet too, because, you know, Diana had a few records out before this, but this was the one that she went back to her old team of Tommy LaPuma producing and Al Schmidt engineering, and I mean, they just outdid themselves again, and it started out already bittersweet because, of course, Doug wasn't around anymore. That was the trio. And so it was both bittersweet and, you know, the honor of my life to be chosen to master this by those guys. And, you know, and very strange to come full circle too, you know, especially with Al working with Al so closely after, you know, he was my first real teacher.
And now your peers, essentially.
Yeah, it's strange, but there's something you can learn every day. There's no question there.
My philosophy of life, no doubt about that.
It's just totally an honor always getting to work with him. And then shortly after this record, you know, was even more devastating when Tommy passed away shortly after we worked on it. So it was...
Tommy is...
Tommy LaPuma, the famous producer.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so it was difficult, but you know, I love this record. It sounds incredible too. And you know, the going back to the challenge you were asking about, specifically on the vinyl end, it was very challenging because of all the sibilance that was involved, of course.
Meaning high frequency S kind of sounds.
Exactly. Yeah. Diana's style is, you know, a very close, intimate sound on the mic, of which, you know, Al excels at that sound too. And so you have all vocal very, very close and intimate, and sibilance therefore is extremely easy to come by and very strong. Yeah. And if you guys are familiar, there's one thing vinyl does not do, which is anything remotely resembling sibilance. It just causes huge distortion and breakup, and it's just no bueno. So especially considering that one of the songs that she sings on there is Sway.
Every time that word comes up, it's like,
oh yeah. Yeah. So the trick on that one was actually I went in between my actual master, the high res master, which was, you know, straight off of Al's board, and then the stems, meaning breaking up the vocal, the instrumental and whatnot, so that I could treat all of those bad S's very aggressively on just the vocal track and not the whole thing. Mm. And there's something like 500 edits throughout the entire program, because literally I'm editing in the stems that wouldn't sound quite as good into the real master just for that moment of time on an S, and that'll make you sweat.
On time. Yeah, especially if you're working on Diana Krall's voice.
Oh yeah. And I like to think that type of care is definitely one thing to separate the men from the boys, but we pulled it off. So, and the vinyl has been getting incredible reviews. So I'm really, really proud of, you know, just the engineering as a whole.
I wanted to touch quickly upon something you mentioned a little earlier. You said you worked on something called Mastered for iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
And the first album that was released, quote unquote, mastered for iTunes was Colby Calais.
Colby Calais.
Ah, I should have known.
That's okay.
Colby Calais. And there she is with you on the cover of Mix Magazine.
Yep.
Tell us just a bit about what is Mastered for iTunes.
Mastered for iTunes was quite a fun little thing that I got thrown into, and it was all because I'm originally from New Jersey and was aggravated by having to set up a phone call with an Apple executive. An Apple exec came out of nowhere and wanted to speak with me just because they had upped their quality to 256. They were very proud of it, but like it was at a time when I guess all of us professionals were complaining about the sound of iTunes, and they wanted to, I don't know, have a pat on the back or something and talk with people and try to get their perception back. And so randomly I get this call and it's like an assistant wanting to set up a phone call. I'm like, well, yeah, I'm around. Just call. Cool. And they're like, no, how about next Thursday? It was like literally a week and a half later at 2:03 p.m. I was like, you can't be serious. And they're like, are you great? And I was just like, yeah, sure. And then I totally forget about it. And the next week, you know, the front office, James calls me and he's like, you have a phone call from Apple. And I look down at my watch and it's 2:03. And I was like, well, you know, F me. Pick up the phone, get this guy, he starts talking. And so, you know, I was aggravated by this like craziness of this stupid phone call. And he starts telling me about like the perception and blah, blah, blah. And wanting to be a prof- professional format. And I just cut him off. I was like, if you want to be a professional format, I want to know why what I send sounds nothing like what comes back off the store. Where is everything getting messed up? And why are we working with CD Masters? And I just laid into him everything that was just so obviously wrong about the distribution system, which the main problem was we were still in the age of the CD. So the only thing we were delivering to the labels were DDPs or PM CDs, which are literally burned CDRs of the album. Like it was meant everything.
They duplicated, they produced CDs copying that thing.
Exactly. And I swear, I mean, there must have been interns at labels uploading, putting in CDs and uploading to iTunes. And that's what the catalog was being made out of. I was like, this is ludicrous. You know, first of all, it should only be files. That takes away all this problem of conversion and whatnot. And then, you know, aside from that, even if you're making an encode, like a lossy format, it doesn't mean that you start with the crappiest sounding, you know, format that you can. Like, you can at least increase the bit depth and you're going to have more resolution for your encoder to work from. And so he agreed and was very strange on the phone. He's like, okay, I'll have that for you tomorrow. And then the next day I get a call from the chief of Core Audio. And in my email is a white paper marked confidential. And it's literally everything that I asked for. Huh. And we start talking.
The next day.
And we start talking. And I start looking in the paper and we start geeking out because he realizes that I'm the only music engineer he's ever spoken to who actually understands like DSP. And we start talking and everything. And I was like, wait, who the hell was I talking to yesterday to have you calling me and to have a white paper already? And he's like, oh, he reports to Steve Jobs. I'm like, right. Got it. So that's kind of the story of how this came about. And, Colby's record was the first since we were happened to be working on it at the time. And we went from there and at the time, actually it took a few months before they even coined the phrase mastered for iTunes. And I don't know if it still exists on iTunes. I would assume it does, but if you go to, it was her album All of You. If you go to the actual album on iTunes in the description, it's some like lame attempt of explaining that we did something different, like, and something specifically engineered for the sound of iTunes or, you know, something along those lines.
But really all it was starting from a higher resolution master to encode it to MP3 or AAC or whatever.
Exactly. And, you know, the main thing that I'm proud of with that isn't necessarily what's on the iTunes store and what everyone's downloading. The thing I'm proud of is overnight doing this changed the distribution model of the entire record industry. After that day, every record label was asking for WAV files and for high-res files, and it opened the door for properly sending checksums, WAV files to like HD tracks. And suddenly, you know, It changed everything. Like when we used to have to send masters to HD tracks, like the labels literally didn't know what to do. And after this, like the infrastructure now was there and, you know, people actually got off their ass and did something about the fact that this is really the master format now. So that was the cool thing about Mastered for iTunes that, happened very quickly, and of course on the consumer end you would never see,
right, except for maybe that little note in some of the tracks on iTunes.
Right.
Well that brings
the whole marketing thing that came after.
That brings up the whole issue of the importance of high-res audio, which we've talked about on the show a number of times. And so obviously one of the key elements and important points of high-res audio is how you're delivering that audio to whoever's going to actually make the final distribution product, right?
Right. So to put it more specifically, like, I guarantee you, if anyone goes to the AES this year, there's going to be some douchebag over there doing some AB between, like, a CD and a high-res file. And everybody loves to compare, here's the high-res and here's the CD. And do you hear a difference? And of course, if you're working from the same source, you're going to need a room like mine. You know, you're not going to pull someone off the street with earbuds and be like, do you hear a difference? And come up with any statistical value. Mm-hmm. And the point about all of this is anyone who's doing these tests completely misses the importance of high resolution, which is the difference between high res and lower resolutions is when you work with it from day one, when you're recording in high res, when you're mixing in high res, you're mastering in high res, especially now that so much of our work is being done in the box, you know, without analog stuff. Like, there's many times where I'm doing strictly digital mastering because on the product, it's just sounding better. And so working in high resolution is incredibly important in that regard, because it's not necessarily a matter of, can you hear the difference between two converters or two file formats? It's the more resolution and the more information that your DSP and your plugins and your mixing inside of your computer, even when it comes out onto the console, has to work with, it comes up with, guess what, a better sound. So the only true way that you'd ever be able to compare, let's say, 44.1 to the 192 is if you took a recording session and recorded it in 44 and 192 and then went through the entire mixing process and mastering process on both of them to compare. But the reason why it would never be fair and you never could set that up accurately is because, of course, the differences in the sound drive your decision-making as you're mixing, heck, as you're recording. These are all artistic and subjective emotional reactions as you're working on it as an engineer. And so you're never going to do the same thing on either format because they do sound different. And when you're working on it that hard, they're going to not only sound different, but those slight differences in sound, like, build up very fast. If you now have 128 multitracks and you have a very, you know, minuscule difference between 44 and 192 that's subjective if you're comparing one track, well, now multiply that little difference by 128.
It becomes something significant.
You'd have to be deaf not to hear it. But that's what we're dealing with. And so the whole high-res debate and whatnot really gets tiresome because it's the whole process that people have to think about. And so in specifically delivering that to listeners, of course, what we're doing now, there's plenty of, like, the Diana Krall record, for instance. Everything was done in 192. Up until if you go on, let's say, iTunes or buy the CD. Of course, I made a 44.1 version. Also up for sale is the 192 version on HD Tracks. The MQA version on Tidal was made from the 192. And then the vinyl was made from the 192, plus all that de-essing and whatnot. But what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. Do all those different versions sound significantly different to your ears?
I tried my best not to make them sound significantly different.
Of course, your goal was to make them sound as close as the same as possible.
And so, you know, the reason why they sound pretty damn similar is because I actually manipulated that. But, you know, the main thing here is, in a perfect world, we wouldn't have to deal with these other formats because we could just deliver to you guys what was making the record in the first place. And that's the true goal of high res right there.
is delivering what you heard in your studio as closely as possible.
On this record, you can buy it on HD Tracks. You can get the 192, but imagine if we just had. It's just a matter of you skip a step. Like, we don't have to make the 44 one. We don't have a conversion factor if everybody were to get to listen to the 192 in this case.
Right. Well, listen, we've come to the end of a fascinating hour. I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing your expertise and your experience and some great stories. Thanks so much for being here, Eric.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thank you to the questions, too. They were really great.
Yeah, they always are. I got a great chat room, I always say. So that's Eric Boulanger. He is the mastering engineer founder of The Bakery Audio Mastering Studio in L.A., and you can find more about him and his work at thebakery.la. You can find me always at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at avsforum. And you can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg. And on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit. Home Theater Geeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Don Eklund. He's an executive VP at Sony Pictures in the same location where Eric is. But he also works with the UHD Alliance. And he's going to bring along a couple of his colleagues from the UHDA to talk about UHD Blu-ray and the whole new video world that we are now in the process of entering. So I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.